Okay, so what we're going to talk about, I'm going to try to go through fairly quickly because we've got a bunch of material, and I want to make sure that I leave some time for questions. But if we don't, I'd ask you if you'd kind of save your questions if you could, so that we can get through the material. If we can't get to the questions and we don't cover everything, I will be here afterwards, and you can come up and talk to me. Plus, I make myself available. I'll tell you this now. I'll tell it to you later, so you can utilize it if you want. This is kind of a ministry of Hume to you. So anybody who comes to retreats, comes up to Hume, that's what we call one of our partners. This is an extension of what we can minister and how we can help you. I make myself available to you if you would like to use this opportunity. I mean, when do you have an attorney tell you that they'll talk to you individually for free? But that's the deal. If you come to the retreats, I have sign-up sheets at the front. I travel around the state as part of what I do. I do these seminars, and then I live off the hill. And I will actually come and visit geographical areas. And like, for instance, in 2 weeks, I'm going to be in the Central Coast area. And I have about four or five families that have said, we'd like to meet with you and talk about not only these issues, but maybe even give us a second pair of eyes, a different look at what we've already done, and tell us if it's up to date or whatever we might need to do. That's a free, no obligation opportunity for you if you want to take advantage of it with you and your spouse, or if you don't have a spouse, that's fine. But you just need to sign up at the end and recognize that I do about six of these retreats during the fall and then another six in the winter. So it may be a couple or 3 months until I get around to your geographical area to see you, because I have a home I want to stay in some myself. I can't be on the road all the time. Last year I was actually on the road. I was in hotels 92 nights, and I decided that's not going to happen this year. It's too much time away from home. When we talk about this area, first thing we need to talk about is there are three primary goals in estate planning, and we're talking specifically right now about estate planning, not financial planning. So this is the planning that's done for what's going to happen with your stuff. That's a technical legal term, stuff. What's going to happen with your stuff after you're gone, when you're finished with it. The three primary goals are, one, we want to reduce or eliminate estate taxes. And estate taxes are a special tax. In case you don't know this, we have layers upon layers of taxes, different types of taxes. We're taxed when we earn it. We're taxed when we buy something, sales tax. We're taxed when we have investments and they've been profit, they've received profit. That's capital gains tax. And then we're taxed again when we die and we leave too much in our estate, more than what the government says we should have, and that's called estate tax. So most people want to eliminate or reduce the estate tax. Second is we want to avoid or eliminate probate, and we'll talk about what probate is in a second. It's not a tax. And the third is we want to be able to control the distributions. That's who we're going to leave stuff to, how and when we're going to leave it. So those are our three primary goals. By the way, forgive me for my voice. I had vocal cord surgery 5 weeks ago, and it's not healing like it's supposed to, so I sound like a frog, but that's all right. We'll work with it. So the first one, reduce or eliminate estate tax. Fortunately, our Congress has cooperated, and they've been adding more to the exempt amount every year, and this is actually indexed for inflation, so it goes up not every year, but maybe every couple of years we'll see a bump in this. And currently, as of this year, the amount that's exempt, which means this is the amount we can accumulate in our estate and pass on to someone else after we die, we can accumulate up to $5.49 million per person. So if you're a married couple, there's ways to actually even combine that to almost $11 million for a family. So that means that most of us sitting in this room probably won't have to worry about this estate tax unless you have over this amount. In fact, the new tax proposals include proposals to completely eliminate the estate tax. And what's also the parallel law to it is called the generation skipping tax. This is when you leave things to your grandkids instead of to your kids' generation. And the proposal is to eliminate both of those taxes. Now, the downside is they don't ever do anything without somehow trying to replace that income. So there is some downsides, and what the downside is to the new tax proposal is that they'll get rid of the estate and the gift tax, which by the way, or not the gift tax, but the generation skipping, which by the way, doesn't really generate a lot of income for them right now, because I used to work for a firm that dealt with people who had this much money, and every day of the week, we could design plans through use of specialized trusts where even those people didn't pay tax. So if they had the money to afford to do it, they would find ways to be able to creatively avoid this. So it doesn't generate a lot of tax. But what the proposal does say is that they'll get rid of what's called the step-up in basis upon death. And what the step-up in basis on death is affecting is the capital gains tax. The capital gains is what you... if you buy an investment such as a mutual fund and you hold on to it and it appreciates, the capital gains is the difference of what you buy it for and what you sell it for. So the profit in the middle is capital gains, and that's taxed. And so what is happening currently today is that when you die and you leave that asset to someone else, then that asset receives a step up to the current fair market value as of the date of death. And if the person who receives it turns around and then sells it or transfers it, there's only the capital gains to pay for the value of it appreciating from the day they received it until the day they got rid of it. So that means if there's a quick turnaround, they've avoided the capital gains. That can happen twice in a married couple. Where the first spouse dies, everything gets bumped back up to the fair market value. When the second spouse dies, it does it again, and then the kids receive the assets. The trade-off then, what they're doing in this new tax proposal, is they're saying, we'll get rid of the estate and the generation skipping, but we're also going to get rid of that step up in basis upon death so that you'll then have to pay the capital gains tax. Now, if you stop and think about it, that's going to generate a whole lot more income for the government than the gift, than the estate and generation, because very few people pay on that tax. Almost everybody has appreciated property or appreciated assets that they've held for a while, and if they leave it to the heirs, the capital gains tax would apply. So we're hoping that this is not really what's going to happen, because it would actually be a worse situation. But fortunately, there's always creative people out there who will find a way to get around this. It's just a matter of when they do it and what it's going to cost you to get around it. So right now, this tax doesn't affect most people. Probate does, though. Probate is a state law. It's driven by the individual state in which you have your domicile, which is the place where you live. And what this says is it's really, all of this goes back to Old English law that took place in about the 12 or 1300s. And probate was designed to make sure that if you are transferring property, that it had clear title, that your bills were paid, and that the people who are receiving your assets are your heirs, are the proper people to receive it. So those are good goals. The problem today is it has to go through the court system to get these clearances. And unfortunately, the courts are so impacted, especially in California, that it takes forever to get through a probate. The court system, the law mandates in California that there's a 12-month period in which you must go through probates. I handle probates in my private law practice, and I can tell you it's rare to get a probate to get through the system in 12 months, just mainly because the court's so impacted, it's difficult to get the court dates you need to have and get them all in 12 months. So it's time-consuming. It costs money. It generally runs between 4 and 8% of the value of the property, and it also is all public record. So how do we know what causes our estate to go through probate? Because not everyone goes through a probate. Two requirements. One is you must own something. So that means it has to be titled in your name. Your name is on it, a bank account, an investment, a piece of property, And by the way, if you own property with your spouse and it's titled as either joint tenancy or community property, what that really means is it's owned by you because only one of you, the one who's the last to die, is going to have it in their name alone. So that fulfills the requirement of ownership. So it's owned in your name, and the second requirement is it must exceed a certain threshold value. And the value is determined by the type of property it is. There's two types of property. There's real property, which is real estate, and then there's personal property, which is everything else. That could be bank accounts. It could be all of your things, your possessions, your furnishings, your clothing, all of those things. And if it's real estate, in California, the value can only be $50,000 or less than $50,000. If it's $50,000 or more, it's going to trigger a probate, go through the court system. Well, how many of you own property in California that's worth less than $50,000? I doubt there is anything. The other personal property, it can be up to $150,000. So, or the combined value of your low value real property and the personal property together ends up being 150 or more. So the problem is that we have to that most people are going to trigger a probate if they own any kind of real estate in California if it's owned in their names. Yes. Yes. So this is our problem, is that most people are potentially in California subject to this probate. The probate's expensive. It can run between 4% and 8% of the gross value of all your assets. And of course, it takes a long time. So how do we get rid of that? How do we get rid of the probate? Well, we get rid of one of those two requirements. Remember, the two requirements are ownership in our name and the value. Well, the only way to get rid of value is to get rid of our things and not have them and for our use, and that's not a good solution. So the technique that's been used is to change the ownership of those while we still maintain all the use and the management and enjoyment. And the technique that we've used for actually centuries now is what we call a living trust. And I'm going to give you an illustration here so you can see what it is. A trust kind of functions like a bucket. And into this bucket, we transfer the ownership interest of our assets. So for instance, for me, I'm going to have my keys illustrate my house. I have money. This is it's true. I make the big bucks. So all of my things, I'm transferring into here. So for instance, my house, the title on my house reads, David and Judy Harrison as trustees of the Harrison Family Trust. So what a trustee is, it's the only person who has the management of these assets. I can take assets out of the trust and use them freely. I can refinance my house if I need to. I can put things in and take them out. But the key is that everything that's in this bucket on the date of my death is technically not owned by me. It's owned by my trust. My trust is kind of like a corporation. It exists on paper. It doesn't really have a tangible existence. But my trust functions just like a will, and it says, at my death, give these things to these people, my beneficiaries. If it's my spouse continues to function as the sole trustee, and she can do anything she needs to with any of the assets during her lifetime, or if someone has to step in our later years and manage things for our benefit, we may appoint a successor trustee, but the assets can only be used for our benefits, the creators of the trust. So then the trust, everything that's in that bucket at the date of my death is not subject to probate. So I've transferred all of the assets that I own into this bucket, gotten free use and management and enjoyment of all those assets during my lifetime, which is the same thing as ownership. And then I've determined where it's going to go after I've died. So it accomplishes all the same goals, but it allows you to avoid a probate. So that's the technique that's the most common technique today. Yes?
Is there a downside to that at all?
The only downside is that it's slightly more cumbersome when you're doing things like having to refinance or do something where... And I was using an example earlier before everyone came in about how some banks just like to push you around a little bit. And the requirements of some banks are that when they finance or fund a loan, they want to see the entire document, which in most cases, the document's going to be anywhere from 25 to, it could be 100 pages if you have a very complex estate. And so that means you've got to provide a copy to the bank. Well, in reality, the California law, the legislature passed a law back around 25 years ago that says that they are not allowed to request documents, the full documents, that have your personal private information, such as your beneficiaries and things like that. They're only allowed to see the parts that are pertinent to the actual funding of the loan. And so there's what's called a certification of trust that's under the probate code that says they are allowed to see this certification of trust, which is a four-page summary of all the pertinent information that applies to them. Some banks push you around. And I actually had a situation in June where I was refinancing. The bank required the entire trust document from me to for me to be able to take title in the name of my trust. And I pushed back and I said, no, California law says you have to accept the certification. And I said, that's what I've been telling my clients for 25 years. I'm not going to do something that I tell my clients they don't have to do. And they came back to me and they said, no, we want the entire document. And so I cut and paste the entire probate code section that includes a paragraph that says that they're liable for damages to me if they've fail to accept this and require the entire document because it's an invasion of my privacy. And so they came back 2 days later and they said, no, we require the entire document or we won't fund. And I was just scratching my head going, but did you read the part that says you're liable for damages to me? And so I sent a note back to them and I said, okay, well, here's what we're going to do. I'm not going to fund it in the name of my trust because I'm not going to violate what I tell people not to do. It's disingenuous. I said, what I'm going to do instead is the day after after the loan's funded, I'll just re-record the deed in the name of my trust. I said, but by the way, I will be asking you for who's accepting service of process because I'm going to sue you for damages because that's what I'm entitled to do, which are minimal. It would be the cost of me having to, you know, refile the deed. So interestingly, 2 days later, they came back and they said, we've decided to accept the certification of trust. Now, I asked the broker, I said, so what was really going on behind the scenes? And he said, they never accept the certification of trust. He said, it was only because you pushed back so hard that they accepted it and the fact that you sent them this your emails on your letterhead. Otherwise, they would have just pushed you around. And so in response to your question again is the only downside is occasionally you may have to go through a little hoop like that. But I'll tell you, it's well worth it because if you start calculating the price of a probate and the delay that it costs your family, it can be a huge, huge inconvenience for your family. So it's well worth trying to avoid a probate. He asked if a simple will avoid a probate. Well, I'll let you answer that question yourself. A simple will distributes things owned by you at the time of your death. Now, remember the definition of what causes a probate? Assets owned by you over a certain value. So a simple will not avoid a probate because it's distributing things that are owned by you. So a simple will... And why is there such a big deal about trusts now? Why is everybody supposedly pushing trusts? Well, it goes back to those threshold values. 40, 50 years ago, people didn't have enough assets to trigger a probate. The value wasn't that high. But after World War II, everything has shifted and changed. We've begun to acquire personal wealth. The average person now has assets that would exceed the minimal threshold level. So therefore, people are looking for solutions. How do we avoid a probate? So it's not that things are being pushed. It's just that our asset value now for the average person has increased. Yes?
You're talking about trust in California. So is it easy to transfer to other states if you start moving around?
Okay, the question is, We are talking specifically about California law. Is it easy to move around if you have a California trust? And I hate to say this, but the answer to a lot of the questions is the same. It depends. And it really depends upon the state you're going to. There's a lot of reciprocity, meaning that we accept documents back and forth, between the states in the western United States. So to Texas west and then up the coast, because we all have very similar laws. We have community property laws. But if you transfer things all the way back to the east coast, Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York, states like that, you have to first understand that they look at people from California as being the land of fruits and nuts. And so any documents created in California are going to be suspect just because of where they came from. They don't like them. So as a result, we don't have a lot of reciprocity between states way back on the eastern seaboard. So it really depends. In most cases, what you should be able to do is you should be able to just change the state of domicile, which is one of the paragraphs in your trust, and say, I now live in Arizona, I now live in Texas, or wherever it is. But it may not be that easy. The other issue is the complexities of the documents. And the documents become complex based upon the state law in which you had them drafted. Fortunately, California is probably one of the most complex states to draft the documents. So that means that if you go to almost any other states, your documents will have more language in them than they need. Where if you came from Montana and moved to California, you're not going to have the complexity to stand up to what's going to go on in California courts. So the answer can be, it's a qualified answer, but that's the best I can give you. It really depends upon the state. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the question really boils down to, if you sell the house, is it just as easy to sell the house in a trust as not? And the answer is yes. The trustee signs just like you would if you were a joint tenant. And it's really easy to buy and sell in a trust. There's absolutely really no difference at all right now. Okay, I'm going to move ahead, and if you could save some of the questions until the end, maybe. So we get rid of the ownership issue. That's how we solve that. So we have no estate taxes, no probate if we use a trust, which again, a trust is not necessarily for everyone, but it's the cleanest, most efficient means of solving a problem today in avoiding a probate. By the way, I want to just back up for just a second and talk about, there's a big shift that's taken place over the last probably 50 years that's completely changed the whole landscape of what we're talking about. And the issue is that inheritances have changed in two dramatic ways. One, I've talked to my 94-year-old father and I've asked him, so Dad, what did you inherit when you inherited from your parents? And he kind of chuckles and he said, well, we lived through the Depression. There wasn't much there. He says, my brothers and I split about $5,000 and that was about it because that's all his parents had. Whereas you move forward since World War II, and like I said, personal affluence has now increased for the general public, so the value of what you have now as an average person is astronomically different than what it was 50 years ago after the Depression. So that's the first big change, is there's more money on the table today. The second big change is the form of that money. And back for thousands of years, up until just after World War II, the average inheritance was an asset that was going to be held in the family after after death. It was a family farm, it was a family home, it was a business, something that would be transferred down and held in the family. Today, I challenge you, how many of you think your kids are going to want to move into your house after you die? Well, unless you live in Newport Beach on the coast or someplace like that, Pismo, Pebble Beach, chances are your house is going to be liquidated after you die, and it will be turned into cash. In fact, most of your assets within a short period of time after your death will be liquidated, and what the kids are getting today is checks. And so the way I phrase it is, we now have, for the first time in history, we have generations of lottery winners who are just receiving checks without having to put any blood or sweat into what they're getting. So statistically, what we're able to do is we can look back now and we can say, we have a generation and a half now of these lottery winners where we can watch and see statistically what's happening to them. And guess what? They do the same thing with their assets they inherit as lottery winners do. And we're seeing statistically that almost 90% of what's inherited is not there 5 years later. I mean, it's staggering to see how quickly they blow through it. And it doesn't seem to matter what size the inheritance is. If it's more, they just go through it more. And I've never met a beneficiary who said, oh yeah, I intended to blow through my inheritance. They all have the same story. They say, well, we had this unlimited resource we thought in the bank, and so we felt it was okay to do this remodel, to do this, to go on this trip, to buy this, to go out to dinner all the time, and all of a sudden we turned around and it was gone. And I hear that time after time after time. And so what that's done for me is it's made me decide, I want to do something for my kids that will help them and give them some guidance. Now, what I've discovered is as I sit down and meet with families, and I've met with thousands of families, and so I've had a chance to hear their stories, I'm finding that there are four types of kids that now are represented in our families that are potential problems or issues for us that we need to be planning for. And these four types of kids are, one, the physically or emotionally challenged child. And this is what we typically may call a special needs type of a child. And it isn't necessarily kids that have grown up with physical problems. It can even be kids who have developed problems later in life. Surprisingly, a month doesn't go by that I don't meet with an 80-plus-year-old person who doesn't tell me that they have an adult child who has developed symptoms of either bipolar, anxiety disorders or something like this, that say my child in their 40s or 50s can no longer work and they become disabled. They fit into that category of what's called a special needs person. So we have that issue. How do we deal with those? Because by the way, if you've got a child who's receiving government aid, for instance, they've retired early and receiving Medicare because of a health problem, they may not be able to receive an inheritance outright. If they have assets in the bank, they may not be qualified to receive some of the programs that they're looking to get. So that could be a problem. How do you structure that? Second problem is we have a lot, and again, I would say there isn't probably every other week I hear families who are telling me they have a child or more than one child who's had a substance abuse problem. This is absolutely epidemic. And this is a child who you may not and probably do not want to leave a lump sum to, because even if they've been clean and sober for years, that could really just throw them off the wagon. So we've got to structure those. And this is a really, really big problem. You know, you may not think it is, but it is. So substance abuse, that's another second child. Third child is what I call the financially disabled or challenged child. And this is not a technical definition, but it's what I'm observing, and I'm seeing, again, a tremendous number of these kids who have never become financially independent. And they're kids who are coming back all the time to the bank of mom and dad because they haven't learned how to balance a checkbook, and they're spending more money that as a life pattern than what they make. These are also kids that you may not want to leave a lump sum to because they're not going to manage it well. And then the last is what I call the spiritually challenged child. And this is a child who maybe you raised in your belief system in the church, and they understood it, they knew it, they grew up in it, and now they've rejected your belief system and may be living in a lifestyle completely opposed to what you accept as what is a believer's lifestyle. My question is, do we leave money to a child who's going to be supporting a lifestyle that is opposed to a biblical lifestyle, or that may even, like in some cases I'm aware of, may even use that money to be aggressively supporting that lifestyle that's opposed to our belief system? Do we do that? Well, maybe that's something we should be thinking about. How do we structure that? So these are issues that we're running into with the children. I have some of those issues in my family, and even if you can sit there and say, nope, none of my kids are like that, there's probably a greater than 50% chance that they may have married into someone who's like that. So it's going to be in your family regardless. And so it is something we have to be aware of. So how do we solve that problem? Well, it goes back to the controlling the distributions, and we use our trust again as an example. And what I've done, I've watched for over 25 years what has been successful and what has not been successful. And I've structured my family trust to kind of incorporate those things that I felt have been helpful. So there's a few things I do. First of all, I've found that kids are not maturing financially as quickly today as they did even a generation ago. And there's a reason for that. And I feel like my generation needs to take responsibility, because what we've done is what they technically now call, we've rescued our kids. Anytime they've had a problem or they've had a little issue, mom and dad have been there to pick them up so that they haven't had to suffer the consequences. But the downside is, how do you learn? You learn from failing and picking yourself up and learning how to deal with consequences. So as a result, we've not allowed our kids to suffer consequences, and then therefore they're not making decisions that they probably should have already been able to make. So I'm seeing that age of financial responsibility moving up. And so what I've done with my kids, because of my watching families, I believe now that if something were to happen to me before my kids are 35, my kids haven't lived enough of life, haven't had enough of life's lessons until they're 35 for me to turn the keys to a chunk of change over to them. So my rule is, I've said my kids until they're 35 are not going to be decision makers about their inheritance. So if this is assuming my wife and I are dead, my kids are under 35, I will have a successor trustee that's going to step into my shoes, but they're going to be the same. They're going to do the same thing, have the same rules as I would have had, meaning that if my kids had needs for their health, their education, their maintenance and support, for wedding expenses, for help with a down payment, anything I would have done, my successor trustee can step into my shoes and they can do, but we're not turning the money over to the child until they're at least 35. Does that make sense? It doesn't mean that that's what you have to do, but I'm telling you this is what I've decided to do based upon watching other families. So once my kids turn 35, then I'm going to allow them to be able to have some control over their own inheritance, assuming, again, I'm gone. But before they do that, I found that there's a lot of wisdom in allowing them to have some training or education in basic money management. Okay, so the question is, who do we have step into that role as a successor trustee? Because many of you have probably named your kids as a successor trustees. Well, my personal feeling is I'm not going to put my kids in that role probably ever. And the reason why is because I've watched what it does to the families. And if any of you have had the chance to watch families where one sibling is over the others, over the parents' estate, it absolutely destroys the relationships. There is always suspicion, and even in the families that I have told me, oh, I can guarantee you there's never going to be a problem, there's a problem. So my rule of thumb is, I'm not putting my kids in a position where they're going to be fighting amongst themselves. I'd rather have them fight with a third-party outsider that they could be mad at for the rest of their lives, but they still have their relationships intact. So what I had to do was I had to go outside and say, who would I pick? And it could be a family friend. It could be someone that, like, I have a small group I've been part of for 27 years, and these guys know me, they know my kids, and I know whether or not they could manage things, and I've appointed one of them. It could be a professional. There are professional trustees. You have to pay them, but that's another option. So there's a number of different options you can look at outside of yourself, outside of your family. So going back to what I'm going to require my kids. So they turn 35, and the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to tell them that I want them to receive some kind of a training or education before they end up getting their inheritance. Now, let's say that my kids are over 35 when I die. It's going to take a minimum of 3 months, probably more like 6 months, before my estate is ready to hand things off to my kids after we're gone. Because you've got to sell things, you've got to pay bills, you've got to make sure everything's settled. It's going to take a few months. So during that interim, what I've said is my kids have to go and get some financial training. And there's some really great programs out there. Some of the best are Financial Peace University, which is a Dave Ramsey course, available everywhere, including the internet. It's about 10 hours worth of material that you can take on the internet yourself. And so that's one. There's Susie Orman has one. And then Crown Ministries, a Christian organization, has one called Money Life that is a Christian-based program. All of them about the same amount of time, 10 to 12 hours that they can do either in a group at church or they can do it online by themselves. Or in my case, I've actually bought the DVDs for the Financial Peace University, and I've taken my kids as adults through that program. The point is that this is not going to be the cure-all. It's not going to teach them how to, they're going to all of a sudden become great, but it's going to give them more information than they had before they did this. It's going to teach them about budgets. It's about interests, about debts, about all the different things that they should have picked up that they're not learning anywhere else. So that's my requirement. I said, while you're waiting to get your check, I want you to go through one of these programs. And if my kids push back, which sometimes they have, they've said, well, Dad, why should we do that? My response is, no, it's all right. You don't have to do that, and you don't have to get your inheritance. This is, you know, it's my money, and if you don't want that, then you don't have to follow the rules. I'm not going to force you to do anything. So they usually say, no, it's all right. We'll do it. So that's one requirement. The second requirement I've done for me, again, you do not have to do this, but it's designed to solve a couple of problems. I want to protect my kids from themselves, because the problem, again, with why this money goes so quickly usually is because of what we call impulsive spending. They do things without thinking about it, and all of a sudden they've already done something they can't go back on. So how do we protect them? The second problem is, I want to protect them from other people taking the money away from them. And one of the big ones, we hate to think about it in a Christian camp, but it's divorce. Divorce is, the statistics are now over 60%, even in the church. And quite frankly, if I want my inheritance to follow my bloodline, to follow down through my kids, bankruptcy, lawsuits, judgments, liens, how can we protect them from that? So what I designed was a setup where upon my death, the share for the child, if they're over 35, goes into a separate little bucket for them. And they're going to be their own trustee over their bucket. But my requirement is that I want them, I found there's an infinite amount of wisdom to the biblical concept of a biblical counselor. I said, I want you to pick someone that's going to be your counselor that you're going to run ideas by and you're going to talk to. Now, the point of this is I'm trying to create a speed bump, because if I create a speed bump, it slows down that impulsive spending and it allows them to stop and think about things. If they have to talk to someone and talk through and rationalize why they want to buy all of their friends' jet skis, then maybe they're going to realize that may not be the best idea. So it's going to slow them down. So I said, you have to pick someone who's going to be what in essence becomes a co-trustee, someone who's going to be able to give you some wise counsel. And here's a couple of things. I'm not going to pick the person for them. I'm going to let them pick the person because two reasons. I don't know who's going to be alive at that time, and I don't know who's going to work well with them. I want them to pick someone that they can respect and work well with. But I don't want them picking their best friend who's going to say yes to everything either. So I can give them some qualifications. And I said, you can pick anybody in the world, but one, someone you have control over, meaning control is viewed as a spouse or a sibling or someone in the immediate family that they could potentially control. Two, I want this person, and this is my requirement, doesn't have to be yours, I want that person to be a Bible-believing Christian. Because I want that person to be able to give them the same worldview that I have, and that would be able to give them some idea of what this is a responsible thing to do. This is another area where you could have kids push back. I have a couple of my kids, I have 7 kids, 6 boys and a girl, and I have a couple of kids who are not walking with the Lord right now. They're all adults, and breaks my heart, but that's the case. And they know what I've done, and they know this requirement, and they've pushed back, and they've said, well, I don't understand why I have to pick a Christian. You know, that's not necessarily where I am right now. And, you know, I hate to say this, but I go back to the same thing. I said, that's all right. You don't have to pick a Christian. You don't have to receive this. But this is my rule, and it's my money, and I get to make the rules. And this is what I want you to do. It's not going to hurt you to have someone who's a believer helping you make decisions or being a sounding board. So that's my requirement. And the last requirement is I want it to be someone who at least has some basic financial or accounting understanding so that they can really give some qualified counsel. So what I've told my kids is it can be someone who's just taken some accounting classes, someone who's even gone through one of those financial training programs, someone who's not just the guy off the street who again is going to say, yeah, it's okay to buy your best friend a car. You know, it's someone who can look at it and say, this is a better decision to make. So as long as they meet those requirements, they can pick this person. And by the way, they can hire and fire this person, because my goal is not to keep them from their inheritance. It's to help them from and protect them from them making impulsive decisions or someone taking it away from them. So what this does is if they can hire and fire my oldest child, who, by the way, is one of those I'm most worried about impulsive spending, his comment was, well, Dad, what's to keep me from hiring and firing until I find someone who will say yes to everything? And my answer is nothing. I said, Jake, if you want to blow through this by picking someone the first day that you can manipulate, I said, you can do it. But what you have to recognize is that you've blown something that I've set up for you that has benefits that will last your entire lifetime. The purpose of this is to help you manage things for your lifetime and to protect you. If you decide to take it all out, it's all fair game if you get involved in a divorce or a lawsuit. But if you maintain the rules in here, then there's some qualified asset protection that will allow it to potentially keep you from having to separate and give all the, half of the funds in a divorce or a bankruptcy or whatever it may be. So of course, Jake said, oh, well, Dad, I'd never do that. I was just asking. But just the mere fact that he asks is a concern. So the point is that if they do choose to design this so that they can pick the person and manipulate them, they could get to the funds just as quickly. They just have to jump through a couple of hoops. But the other point is I've set up a skeletal structure for them that if they choose to use it the way it's set up to be used, it will help guide them for the rest of their life with whatever these resources are. So it can be a great benefit to them. Okay, let's talk about a particular asset that's a problem. Most of us are beginning to accumulate assets in our estate that are what we call liquid or cash types of assets through retirement plans. And that could be an IRA, could be a 401k, could be a 403b, a 457. And by the way, in case you want to know where those numbers came from, those are the Internal Revenue Code section that addresses those particular plans. So now you know where the numbers come from. So all of those are plans where we've made a deal with the government, and they've said either pay me the tax now or pay me the tax later. And what we've opted to do is to pay the tax later. So this accumulates, and the best benefit of this is that tax money that we didn't pay up front is also gaining interest. So it's compounding also. So that's one of the big benefits of these plans. There are 2 rules of how these plans can be distributed, and it depends upon who the beneficiary is. So I die and I have a 401k, for instance. My 401k is automatically going to go to my spouse. That's the rule. And my spouse will have two choices. If she needs that money immediately, she can start to take the money from my 401k or my IRA without penalty immediately after my death because she's the spouse. She has that benefit. No one else has that benefit. Or she could choose to roll it over. And if she rolls it over, what that means is she acquires the ownership of that plan, and that plan actually will be treated like her plan, and she can defer the withdrawals until she's either 59 and a half or at the latest 70 and a half. So those are the rules. Does that make sense? So the spouse has benefits no one else has. She can either use it or she can roll it over and continue to accrue it. Now, if both my wife and I are deceased, my kids now become the beneficiaries of these plans. They don't have those benefits. They have to start taking withdrawals the year that I die. And when they take a withdrawal, every time they take a withdrawal, they pay the tax. But it's now calculated at their income tax rate because it's considered income for them. So here's the issue. They have two choices, the kids. They can either take a lump sum withdrawal or they can take a deferred withdrawal that gives them payments annually for the rest of their lives. What do you think a majority of them are going to choose? The lump sum, because to them it represents more cash in their hands than they had yesterday, even though they understand, oh yeah, I may have to pay some tax. Well, that tax is not some tax. It means that if the entire plan were rolled over and they paid it out in a single lump sum to my child, that is all attributed as income to them in the year they received it. So the next April, they're going to have to pay income tax on that. And if it throws up their tax brackets, that means that they could pay a maximum of about 40 to 45% state and federal income tax on that and lose almost half of it. So, an example. Yeah.
Is that not part of
No. Because a retirement plan is like a life insurance policy. It's paid out to the beneficiary. A trust can't ever own them. They have to be owned by a person who has a social security number. So they will never be part of the living trust. So going back to what the options are, here's a quick example. I ran a computer simulation. I took a 52-year-old man and I said he was inheriting a $300,000 IRA from his dad. And what were his options if he took one of those two options? So if he took the lump sum, out of $300,000 after tax, he would get about $167,000. If he did not, if he took it over the annual installment, that meant that the tax that he didn't pay up front continues to compound and gain interest over his lifetime, and he ends up getting almost $600,000 to $700,000 over his life expectancy, which for a 52-year-old is almost 40 years. So obviously the best choice is let it roll and take the installments, but that's not what the kids are going to choose, and you don't get to pick it for them. They get to pick it. So how do we solve that problem? Well, this all kind of changed back around 2006 because we used to make the living trust the beneficiary of our IRA after our spouse. But what the IRS did in 2006 was they issued what's called a revenue ruling, which is their interpretation of the Internal Revenue Code. They issued a ruling that basically disqualified living trust. It picked out language that they call poison pills that are if this language is in your living trust, it accelerates all the taxation immediately if the living trust is the beneficiary. And they drafted the language so that almost every living trust would be disqualified as what they call a qualified beneficiary. So they basically took the living trust off the table because that was the vehicle we used to make the beneficiary of everything. And we just say, okay, living trust, you then distribute down to the kids. So a creative attorney in 2007, a year after the revenue ruling was issued, came out with a new version of a trust, and it's called a retirement plan trust, or an IRA standalone trust. And what it does is it serves as a bucket that sits there during both of your lifetimes, you and your spouse, and it's designed to solely be the beneficiary of retirement plans. And it doesn't have the poison pill language. And in fact, it's already gone through the tax courts and been approved, so it's grandfathered in. And what you're able to do with this that you can't do any other way is, one, you can qualify the age in which the kids are going to start getting distributions. Now, here's the rule. If you die and your kids are under 18, for instance, the year they become 18, they're eligible to make that decision of taking that lump sum withdrawal or taking the annual installments. So young beneficiaries, there's no way to qualify that if you have just a regular beneficiary statement on your IRA. So this allows you to select an age like I did with 35. You can say this is the age where my kids are able to start taking distributions. The second thing it allows you to do is it allows you to select for them which option they're going to pick. And for me, I've decided I want them to not have the lump sum option because they're getting everything from the living trust that they can access right away. I'm going to say this is going to be a plan that they're going to be able to get installments for the rest of their lives and checks, and they're going to allow that tax money to accrue. I'm going to do this for their benefit. So I've pulled the option away and said, that's what you're going to do. The third thing it does is there was actually a court ruling 4 years ago by the U.S. Supreme Court. Your IRA is the only thing you own in your estate that is asset protected, meaning the only people who can take your retirement plan away from you is pretty much the IRS. That the Supreme Court ruling said that only extends to you and your spouse. It doesn't extend to your kids as beneficiaries. So if it goes down to the kids' generation, all of a sudden it becomes fair game for any of their debtors or creditors or divorces or things like that. However, if it goes through this special retirement plan trust, then it becomes asset protected. So you can have it structured here so it's asset protected. So what this does, and when does it become effective to do that? For me, my rule of thumb is if you don't have at least $100,000 in your retirement plan, then it's not effective to do that. It's not cost effective. It's not worth the extra hassle, especially if you have multiple kids where it's going to be divided out. But if you have more than about $100,000, $150,000, then the potential mistake that they could make by taking a lump sum withdrawal is tens of thousands of dollars in taxes. And at that point, it becomes worth it to me to say, you know what, I don't even want to tempt you because you're going to have other assets you can get to. I'm going to take this off the table and I'm going to make the decision for you that you're going to get the best benefit for the dollar and allow it to roll. To me, that makes a lot of sense, and it becomes effective cost-wise because this is a separate trust. This is not your living trust. This is something that you have to have drafted separately, and it's designed to sit there empty during your entire lifetime. But once both you and your spouse die, the beneficiary of your plans go into this trust. Is that making sense at all? It's something fairly new. It's a complex document that has to be drafted by someone who's very much aware of the tax laws. Yes?
Yeah. Let's say that, okay, you passed on, and your wife is the
Yeah, you can absolutely do things like that through a living trust. You don't necessarily have as much freedom with the retirement plans to do that because there are restrictions on how you invest retirement plans. There are ways to purchase property in retirement plans, but you've got to be really careful. And the best way to do what you're talking about is through a living trust because there's all these issues of ownership with the retirement plans. They have to be owned by the person. But that is a solution for a living trust. Yeah.
It doesn't destroy their taxes either.
Right. Yeah. There's all sorts of creative things you can do like that. You had a question?
Yeah.
Yes, that actually is possible, because what's happening is they are going to be receiving their annual distributions. They just won't have access to those distributions until they turn 35. So within their retirement, or within your retirement plan trust that's set up now for them, you have options of how it's going to be invested, because you have that accumulation account that's growing every year, and then you have the principal that hasn't been distributed yet, hasn't been taxed. The accumulation account is after tax. The principal is what hasn't been taxed yet. I need to cover a couple more things, and we're almost right at the time limit. So if you feel like you have to get up and leave, that's fine. But here's a couple of really important things I want to just mention. One is, powers of attorney are incredibly important. They're probably one of the most important documents you can have while you're alive, and make sure they're updated. So if you don't have a will or a trust and you don't feel like you even need one, great, that's fine. But you got to have powers of attorney. Powers of attorney are documents that come into play if something happens to you and you're incapable of making your own decisions. You have a car accident, you have an accident of some sort, you're unconscious for a period of time, whatever it might be. This is really, really important. There's two different powers of attorney. The healthcare power of attorney, which is called the Advanced Healthcare Directive, and then the other power of attorney over everything else. The advanced directive does three things. It nominates who will make decisions for you if you can't make them for yourself. So generally, you'll put your wife and anybody else, which, by the way, on that document, I have my kids, because they're going to be making medical decisions. They're not making financial decisions that affect others. So they can be decision makers. But that's the first thing it does. The second thing it does is it allows you to predetermine what type of life-sustaining measures you want them to take or not take in the event that you're dying and there's no hope of recovery. So this is life support systems. What do you want them to do or not do? Most people say, if I'm dying and there's no hope of recovery, let me die naturally. Don't keep me alive for 10 years like they did Terry Schiavo. So it's that decision you have. The third is what's called the privacy releases, or the HIPAA releases. This is designating who it is that the doctors can talk to about your condition. Incredibly important. And it's also very important that you have these documents for minors, or not minors, but as they reach adulthood at 18. I have a daughter who's now 30, but she was in a car accident at 19, was taken to the hospital. We rushed to the hospital hearing about this accident, and we didn't have a healthcare directive for my 19-year-old daughter, because I thought of her as our baby, but she was a legal adult. So we get there, and the hospital wouldn't talk to us. For 4 hours, we sat in the waiting room, not being able to even be updated about her condition until she was able to ask for us. And it turned out she was just sleeping. But they won't let you talk. They won't talk to you unless you have this document. That's the law. That's even true between spouses. So if you're in an accident and your spouse comes to the hospital without the release saying you have permission to talk to my spouse, then they can't talk to them. So two questions is, how do they get this document? How does the hospital get a hold of this document? And there's a lot of options, but my option is, in my car, if I took you out there right now, I have in my glove box my healthcare directive that names my spouse. I have my wife's, and I have my father's. And I carry them with me everywhere I go, even in my luggage. Because if I get a phone call that my 94-year-old daughter, my dad is being rushed to the hospital, I can drive right to the hospital with this document, walk in there and say, this is me on the document. You can talk to me. And they can talk to me immediately. Now, there are options of how you can do that electronically. You can put it on different vehicles. You can put it on Google Docs and all sorts of things. The problem is just, if you're the one who's unconscious and it's on your Google Docs, how are they going to know how to get access to it? So you have to kind of have the basis covered with other people knowing that, or having your spouse know how to get into those documents or that type of thing. But these are really, really important to have those documents. Yes, sir?
Does that still
What HIPAA says is that you have to specifically name the people to whom medical information is released. If the name does not appear on your HIPAA on your documents that are saying these are the people I've named, then the hospital has the mandate to not release information. Now, will they release information? In a lot of cases, they do. If they recognize that situation, that it's unique, then many times they will. But if they follow the letter of the law, they will not be able to release information to anyone that's not specifically named. That's what the law reads. Okay, the other power of attorney, I'll come back to that in just a second. The other power of attorney that you need to have is the one that covers everything else. It allows someone to step into your shoes and represent you if you're not able to represent yourself. So this could be with the insurance company, with anything that's non-medically related. Could be the IRS if you're unconscious for a while or you become disabled. All of those things. And again, you name your spouse usually and then subsequent people. This one I also say it's probably okay to name kids in that one because they're not controlling distributions, but they're helping to manage. And for instance, if you're disabled, paying your bills for you, things like that. But that's also an important one to cover. Last thing I want to mention is I personally believe we need to, most of you here in this room, because you're here at a Christian conference, probably are of the Christian faith. And it's really important to understand that we are what are called stewards of the things that we've acquired during our lifetime, which means we're managers, but we're not technically owners because ownership means we have complete control, and once we die, we've lost control. It just goes to someone else. We can't take it with us. There's a lot of verses I have to support this, but my personal feeling is that we need to consciously figure out how are we going to be controlling our assets to also influence the kingdom of God and helping to increase the kingdom of God, both during our lifetime as well as upon our death. There's a couple of things that people do. One is they can make a charitable organization a beneficiary in their trust or their will. A lot of people do that, and I actually have in my trust a sliding scale. As my kids get older and theoretically more financially independent, I have more of my estate going to charity because I've helped my kids during their entire lifetime. I've helped them get a means to a living, education, all of that. So I believe my responsibility to my kids diminishes as they get older, and my responsibility to God's kingdom increases. And so I'm having a shift where more and more is going to God's kingdom. And then the other aspect, what one person actually corrected me at one point is they said, well, it isn't really appropriate for us to go to God and say, Lord, because I used to encourage people, pray about this. Pray about what you might want to give to God. And someone said to me, what business do we have to come to God who, if we really believe Scripture, he owns everything and we are just managers during our lifetime. What business do we have coming to God and say, God, out of everything you own, what portion do I have permission to give back to you? That doesn't make sense. He said, what we should be asking instead is, God, if you own everything, which you do, and you've allowed me to manage and accumulate and acquire this during our lives, what percentage do I have permission to give for my kids? You know, and that's a hard thing to hear. And I can tell when I look at audiences, I can tell people who go, yeah, that's right. And those who haven't quite got there where they don't really understand that it's really not our stuff. We've been fortunate to acquire it. There's one verse that I love that's in Deuteronomy that says, beware. This is for the self-made man, the person who believes, who I run into often. He believes that he was the one who did this. He says, beware lest you say in your heart, it is mine, and through the might of my hand, I've acquired this wealth. He said, you shall honor the Lord your God before it is he who has allowed you to be able to acquire your wealth. And if that's really true, then we need to understand and honor God with what we do too. So this is a really big part of what I think your decision-making ability should be. Now, last thing, I have these sign-ups up front. If you would like to have me come and stop by and talk to you personally, I would be happy to do that. I normally like to communicate through email because I'm up here a lot with the phone not working and all of that. So please put your information on these sheets. I have some stuff up here, some materials you might be interested in. I have my business card, of course, and I have two books. This book is covering a lot of the stuff that I didn't even get to today about wills and trusts. It's called Provide and Protect, and it's a great book written by a good man, a good Christian man. And then the other book is about just basic understanding of God's kingdom and his role in our assets. It's called The Treasure Principle by Randy Alcorn. I personally buy books of these boxes of these books to give out during these meetings. If you would like to take one, I will give it to you. If you can help me defer the costs of buying these, I would appreciate it. And if you can, I pay after shipping about $10 for these and about $7 for these. So if you can, I'd appreciate that, but there's no requirement. If you just want to take one or you don't have any money with you, please help yourself. There's also a couple of brochures up here. One is covering that whole thing that we talked about regarding what is a will and what is a trust and what do I need. You're welcome to take that. It's a summary of that. And then the last one is Hume Lake, like most charities, we depend upon charitable donations. The fees you paid for camp this week, this retreat, cover the retreat. But we end up having to fundraise to build buildings, to cover the repaving of our things. Everything is done through fundraising. So if you ever decide you'd like to leave assets to Hume as a beneficiary after your death, this is a brochure that can tell you about that too. So guys, I went over. I appreciate you hanging in there with me. If you have questions, I'll be up here and be happy to answer them for you afterwards. God bless.